Welcome and thank you for joining today's conference, What Matters Now, an alternative approach to investing in the digital transformation. All audio lines have been muted. Please type any questions you may have into the Q&A box and press send. Questions will be addressed during the Q&A portion of this call. Today's discussion may contain forward-looking statements. All statements made that are not historical facts are subject to a number of risks and uncertainty. Actual results may differ materially. Please refer to ARS's website for important legal and disclosure information. With that, I will turn the call over to Andrew Schmeidler.
Thank you, Sarah. Good afternoon, and thank you all for taking the time to join us today. I'm Andrew Schmeidler, and I'm going to be moderating today's call. Today, we're going to be discussing an exciting strategy that we have here at ARS. It's a hedge fund, and it goes by the name Papyrus Capital. It focuses on the technology, media, and telecommunications industries. Papyrus was founded 5 years ago by our colleague Nitin Sacheti, who's running the fund and who joined last year. He joined our firm, I should say, last year. You may have heard Nitin present at some of our prior calls as well. He's a very talented portfolio manager and research analyst and a member of our investment team. As part of the ARS team, Nitin contributes to all of the investment strategies here. It's a pleasure to work with him. He has a very thoughtful and disciplined approach to investing and has accumulated a wealth of knowledge, in particular in the areas of technology, media, and telecommunications. These industries fit squarely within the secular growth themes that we've identified, and by definition, will be with us for many years to come. For those of you who may not be familiar with us, our investment selections are driven by our investment outlook, which identifies important growth themes that we believe offer high probabilities for achieving attractive investment returns. The Papyrus Fund offers a strategy that focuses on a number of areas that we've highlighted for quite some time in our outlooks. At the end of today's presentation, as time permits, we will also be opening up the discussion to questions. With that introduction, I'd like to ask the first question, Nitin, to you. The term hedge fund, it means different things to different people. What is a hedge fund, and where does Papyrus sit within the hedge fund space?
Well, first, thanks, Andrew. It's been, great being part of the ARS team. Everyone is so thoughtful, so I'm excited to be involved. So that's a good question. So the term hedge fund is certainly very broad, and it connotes so many different types of funds, from quantitative-oriented funds to more derivatives-type funds. But the overarching factor amongst all of the funds is that there's flexibility and independence that the manager has to do whatever he or she wants. Sometimes this lends itself to bad actors and excessive risk-taking, as managers seek to generate extremely high returns. But we look at things very differently. So we believe the flexibility of the structure allows us to invest with very favorable returns for a lower level of risk than the overall market. So how do we do that? One, we tend to run concentrated. So we have a few large eggs in the basket, and we watch those eggs very carefully. And I'll get into more of the research process later and just the types of businesses we're looking at that comprise those large eggs that are our largest positions and why we believe the risks in them are lower for a number of reasons than the overall market, whereas the reward is higher. Second, we tend to take positions in special situations. So those tend to have sort of a higher level of complexity to them, which creates some of the discount that more plain vanilla investors don't necessarily want to invest in. Sometimes these names tend to be a little bit less liquid. So investing in them through a partnership structure like a hedge fund really helps us to be able to be a little bit more nimble in terms of owning these sorts of names. And third, the differentiating factor is really the shorts. So we tend to short very small. So we short somewhere between 15 and 30 cents for every dollar that we're long. And that's a general range, but sometimes it varies. And for us, the shorts are really portfolio insurance in the same way that we wouldn't buy a house without getting insurance on it. The way we look at shorts is we're shorting what we believe are broken businesses. And I'll get into some examples of this later, but businesses where we think the earnings of the business a few years down the road is very different than what the market expects. And so if we're shorting these sort of bad or broken businesses, hopefully when markets go up, we break even or, you know, hopefully make money. But when markets go down, these types of names usually tend to go down more than our longs. So, you know, as markets go up in the long run, we think that these that this level of portfolio insurance sort of differentiates us and, you know, allows us to lower the overall risk in the portfolio. So we sort of combine these three factors and, you know, how we run the flexibility of the structure with the overall ARS outlook in terms of sort of what we think are the longer term secular drivers of, you know, really the world and businesses. And we sort of factor all of that into our investment analysis and our portfolio.
Great, thanks. So can you talk a little bit more about your background and how it informs the way we invest in Papyrus?
Yeah, of course. So in terms of my background, I got into the investment management business about 15 years ago, first at Ampere Capital, which was a spin off from More Capital, the telecom portfolio manager from More Capital. You know, really thoughtful, really, really phenomenal investor. And he taught me a lot. And, you know, look, it was nice that his daughter actually interned for us a couple years ago. So we were able to pay it forward. But, you know, his focus was on just long-term secular growth, stable free cash flows of businesses, and more than anything, investing in just great owner managers who were very thoughtful stewards of capital. And so that's sort of a lot of what we bring to the table in the Papyrus investment process. But, you know, from there, I worked at Tiger Europe, which was, you know, the European of the Tiger seed fund. So Julian Robertson, you know, legendary investor, started Tiger in the 70s, was one of the, you know, grandfathers of the hedge fund industry. And, you know, he had a focus on just sort of feet on the streets research, combining sort of the theoretical of learning about businesses by reading about them with really going to industry trade shows, developing a Rolodex of industry experts. And so that's sort of a lot of what we do at Papyrus to get comfortable with the names in which we're involved. And from there, I worked at Cobalt Capital, where, you know, I managed the TMT investments. And Wayne Cooperman at Cobalt had a very rigorous framework around catalysts. And so that's so important in terms of some of the names in which we invest that tend to be less followed by the market. And so, you know, you don't necessarily have the sorts of fund flows because everybody's watching some of these names. So you really need a company-specific catalyst to really unlock value. And I'll get into, you know, some examples of these company-specific catalysts we have in the portfolio and our names. But that in a nutshell is, you know, my background. And in terms of the overall Papyrus portfolio and how we bring all of that together, we really think about our investments based on three buckets. So the first bucket is what we call well-managed long. So these are, you know, the positions I mentioned before that are the big eggs in the basket. You know, our top five names are about 40% of our portfolio overall. So these tend to be in businesses that are run by great managers, steering the businesses through obsolescence risk, which is so important right now, just given how much technology is disintermediating so many businesses. So, you know, they steer the company through obsolescence risk, through business cycles, and they really think about the most optimal capital allocation, excuse me, for their businesses. So this tends to be the bulk of our portfolio, about 14 to 18 names, somewhere between 3 and 12% of the portfolio each, and an overall exposure of about 40 to 70% of the portfolio. The second bucket is what we call opportunistic longs. And so these tend to be names that are a little bit, you know, shorter term oriented, you know, they tend to have some higher risks to them. So, you know, many of these names are cyclical. They're often in, you know, businesses that might be secularly declining, but we think in these names, the market has over extrapolated a single data point and, you know, caused these names to drop pretty significantly. And we think the market is just sort of missing the opportunity. So in early 2016, when the world was fearful of China's macroeconomic issues, you know, cyclical tech, cyclical chemical companies traded down 50, 60, 70%. So we were in the market buying these businesses at what we thought was, you know, 3 to 4 times normalized PE or earnings. And so, you know, we had the opportunity to step step in when we thought there was a lot of fear and sort of blood on the streets. And so, again, like I mentioned, these tend to be levered. They tend to be cyclical, secularly declining. So they don't necessarily have the best management teams. So we size these names smaller. So we size them on average 1-3% each, about 12 to 15 names. So that's 20 to 35% of the portfolio. So what you see from our long exposure is that, you know, we really are layering the bulk of the portfolio in these great businesses that are with predictable cash flows, secular growth. They really fit our ARS outlook in terms of secular growth. They're run by great management teams, and they're just slowly, steadily building value with a lot less risk than the overall market. And then, you know, we're opportunistic about what we're layering on top of that. And we're sort of enhancing returns through some of these advantages that are opportunities that the market gives us when the market is sort of being more emotional or over extrapolating the short term. And the third bucket is finally the shorts. As I mentioned before, we tend to short names that we think are broken businesses. So, you know, we were shorting security camera companies several years ago when there was increased competition from, you know, Asian manufactured security cameras, and so we were shorting the U.S. and European companies. And, you know, that the Asian companies were selling their cameras at about 50% discounts. And, you know, we were doing work with an industry body called IPVM that basically monitors pricing and the data around security camera pricing. And so, you know, I think that the idea here is that we're looking for these businesses, you know, the Fitbits or GoPros of the world, right out of the IPO gates, where the market thinks they're going to keep on earning significantly for a long time. And, you know, we look at the competitive angles, we look at sort of that innovator's dilemma that they're hitting, and we, you know, short these businesses in, you know, small size, just given the volatility inherent around shorts. And so, you know, we short about 15 to 30 names. The average short is somewhere between 40, 50 basis points to, you know, just over 1%. And, you know, that's about 10 to 25% short exposure. So as I mentioned earlier, we're using the shorts really as an insurance policy. We think these 10 types of names tend to go down a lot more than the market in market declines. So, you know, one, they offer us the ability to, you know, sort of buttress the drops you might see in the longs in those particular markets. And two, they allow us to be aggressive when, you know, the market declines, because, you know, we've offset some of the losses from the longs. So we can tend to step in like we did in, you know, February, March, April of 2020, and increase our long exposure by cutting down our shorts that have already dropped. So it allows us to be offensive when the world is being more defensive. It allows us to, yeah, you know, gives us an insurance policy. So that's really the portfolio in a nutshell.
Great. So can you walk us through the process a little, including how we identify and conduct research on the investments and how we monitor them?
Yeah, of course. So, you know, in terms of the investment process, you know, we tend to, you know, we have four buckets. And so the four buckets, you know, the first starts with idea sourcing. And the idea sourcing really is looking at secular trends that sort of fit our ARS outlook, just thinking about the world and how it's changing. We have a network of industry experts that we work with. And sometimes, you know, I've gotten calls from them saying, oh, you should look at this particular opportunity or this industry because it's interesting. You know, we run screens. You know, some of the screens we run, we look for on the long side, we look for insider buying plus company buybacks, because when insiders believe their stock is cheap and the company, and they're, you know, investing with their own wallets along with, you know, the company's balance sheet, we think there's usually an opportunity there. You know, we run a number of short screens. The most interesting one that we run is insider selling after a big drop in a stock, because often what that shows us is the first cracks are in, but, you know, the company, you know, management team is still selling because, you know, there's potentially more to come. So, you know, those are some of the ways we source ideas. The other thing that we do, I think, which is differentiated, is since, websites like Amazon have become a large distribution point for a lot of companies in terms of selling, because so many people are, you know, buying goods on Amazon these days. Amazon has bestseller lists. So, you know, we, you know, have sort of a group of Python programmers that we work with who help us, you know, web scrape different websites to get us, give us a sense of, you know, is this particular company's products for consumer-oriented businesses in the Amazon top 25, top 50 bestseller list. Has that changed? Has pricing changed? And so by sort of scraping and monitoring that data regularly, you know, that usually gives us some interesting ideas too. You know, from there, we move to what, you know, we call the theoretical phase. And so this is a lot of reading. It's basically the company's filing sell side research for a couple years. It is, you know, industry trade journals, transcripts, you know, and we try to build a theoretical understanding of the business. And then we try to model the business out. So, you know, modeling out the, what are the revenue drivers? What are the earnings drivers? You know, what are the unit economics? If they're spending X to acquire a customer, how long does that customer stay, and how much cash flow does that customer incrementally generate the business? So we're looking at these unit economics. We're really trying to understand just the drivers of the business. And I think the reading and the modeling really helps with that. And from there, we move to, you know, what we call the practical stage. And again, this goes back to sort of what I'd mentioned about Tiger and really marrying the theoretical with the practical. The theoretical, you know, gives you some sense of the business, but it's really, you know, the feet on the streets research. It's attending industry trade shows when, you know, pre-COVID and hopefully soon post-COVID. It's talking to the management team, talking to industry experts, and then really fine-tuning or adjusting the model based on some of these practical conversations. And, you know, from there, it's the conclusion. It's defining the price target. It's determining the position size in terms of which of our buckets does it fit into? And, you know, what is the risk level? What is the downside protection? And, you know, how long will it take for us to realize a potential return on the investment? So that's really sort of soup to nuts, the investment process.
You mentioned investing in companies that have great owner managers. How do we go about finding these executives and vetting them?
That's a great question. And that is so much of our process. And so we think that the market tends to look at PE multiples and they tend to look at growth rates. But sometimes the market misses the importance of management and the importance of management sort of building a business, you know, buying back stock when it's cheap, making acquisitions at the right times, you know, paying down debt at the right times, using debt as, you know, thoughtfully as a resource for, you know, accretive returns to the overall business. You know, we are looking for management teams that, you know, practice patience. We were invested in a company that made a large acquisition. And so we studied the previous 10 years of acquisitions they made to understand how much experience management had with, you know, integrating assets. And so that's sort of this history of favorable acquisition integration. You know, we think management teams that if they find opportunity, but they can't really swallow the deal themselves, are they thoughtful about leverage, joint ventures, you know, hybrid instruments? These are sort of all the ways we think that, you know, a thoughtful, creative management team can really build value. And that's what we're looking for. And, you know, most importantly, management skin in the game. What is their incentive structure in terms of how they're compensated? How much stock do they own? Just like, you know, our investors, you know, we look at the management teams as our partners. And, you know, similarly, investors in you know, our ARS strategies realize that, you know, I have the majority of my liquid net worth in, you know, the strategy. And we want the management teams to have the same incentive structure. And so, you know, the last thing I'll tell you on management is I'll give you two examples. So Company A and Company B, Company, and say both of them are generating about 5% earnings growth and are, you know, trading at 10 times earnings. And let's say Company A is dividending you the earnings stream. And company B has a great management team that's reinvesting, let's call it, you know, rolling up an industry at a 15% annualized return. So every year, the cash flow they generate, they reinvest in acquisitions in this case. And on those acquisitions, they generate a 15% annualized return. By year five, on a free cash flow basis, the second company, company B, will be worth about 54% more. And so that is really the power of compounding, as we all know. And sometimes the market misses that when they just look at headline multiples and growth rates. And so our process is taking that one step further, really understanding management and investing with, you know, the management teams we view as really the best out there.
Great. So if we turn to examples now within the Papyrus Fund, can you describe some of the great managers and the businesses that they're building?
Yeah, of course. So one of our larger holdings is Dish Networks. And so Dish, so let me start with the current / legacy business. So Dish has historically been a satellite TV provider. So, you know, you're in a rural area and you don't have sort of cable. And so the way you access television is by having a satellite dish on your roof, just like, you know, DirecTV or Dish. And this business is now in secular decline. And the reason for that is because with, you know, cord cutting and streaming on Netflix, customers are tending to cut their video service from something like a Dish as they use sort of the streaming service, these streaming services. So Charlie Ergen, founder of Dish in 1980 with $500,000 in savings, which is the company's worth about $20 billion today, he started recognizing that his business was in, his legacy business was in decline in 2010, 2011. And in 2012, he bought Spectrum. And so Spectrum, I've talked about it in a number of these calls beforehand, is the medium by which our phones talk to, you know, the cell phone tower, or satellite dishes talk to, you know, the satellites in the sky. And so with the advent of smartphones and more video that we're watching over our phones, the spectrum is basically, the more spectrum a carrier like Verizon or AT&T has, the faster the speeds and the more data that they can send to your cell phone through that network. And so what Charlie Ergen realized was that there were these two bankrupt companies with satellite spectrum. And so he bought them in bankruptcy, and he petitioned the FCC to convert that satellite spectrum to terrestrial, or, you know, spectrum for our cell phones. And so, you know, it had significantly more value because of, again, that scarcity value of the smartphone spectrum. And so he was able to convert that value into, you know, that $3 billion that he spent into $30 billion plus in value. Now, the interesting thing is he continued to amass more and more spectrum on top of what he had originally bought in 2012. And so now there's a new opportunity at Dish, which is what we're really excited about. And we see Charlie is just so astute in terms of how he's pivoted the business. And, you know, he was nice enough to spend some time with me in 2018 and 2019 in Denver, and just sort of give me a better understanding of sort of what he's doing here. And so, you know, what he's essentially doing is he has what's called a greenfield network, or sort of a blank sheet of paper by which he's building the country's fourth wireless network. So the first three being Verizon, AT&T, and T-Mobile Sprint. And so what Charlie's doing here is he is so building this new network from scratch. Essentially means he has a lot more flexibility in how he builds it, which means it'll be cheaper and it'll disintermediate, you know, the legacy wireless companies. And so the reason for that is because legacy wireless companies built their networks where they had on every tower and every wireless tower, they had an antenna at the top of the tower. And then they have, you know, a shed at the bottom of the tower that basically has servers and storage in it. And so what's essentially happened is that, you know, when the network needed to work instantaneously, you needed to have the servers and the storage on the tower, the same way that, you know, historically businesses had servers in closets, and now, you know, the world has moved to the cloud, right? The same way as I mentioned in a previous call, if you think of nearline server and storage in your house, the most simple form of that is, you know, you put a DVD in and you watch a movie, versus now when you're calling a movie from the cloud, you're, you know, pressing a button and Netflix is beaming that signal to you, you know, from storage in the cloud. And so what's happened since those legacy networks were built, kind of coming back to this example, is that you've had fiber optic cable essentially connected to every tower in the country. And so when Charlie Ergen is building this new network for Dish, what he's able to do is just build a dumbed down antenna on the roof, or basically on the tower. And then he's able to take the server and the storage and put that in the public cloud or the data center. And so that makes it cheaper to build the network. And it also makes the network more flexible, where you don't, when you have troubleshooting issues, you don't have to have, you know, people go out to the tower and try to fix it. Because all of that is in the data center, where it's where the you know, the servers and the storage are working better. And so, you know, the other value here is that there's more flexibility to effectively parse out the network. So if, you know, the example I was given was, you know, Tesla, by an industry expert, is Tesla decides that they want to set up a small network in Northern California, and they want to link it through, call it a few hundred towers. It's easy for Dish to basically send a software update, portion out part of their network to somebody like a Tesla, where then Tesla has its own closed network within Dish's network in a particular geographic area. And that allows, you know, them to effectively wholesale, but then call that network their own. And the prices at which Dish will sell out that network, because their costs are so much lower, will allow somebody like a Tesla to actually make a margin if they charge a customer, or an Apple to do the exact same thing, which is the example, you know, Charlie Ergen's used, where Apple can now sell you a cell phone network and they can get a recurring revenue stream along with the sale of the device. And so all of that is really possible with Dish's network. And, you know, they're in the process of building it. They've really just started. So it's a concept at this point. But we've looked at two similar networks that were built, one in India, Reliance Jio, and the other in Japan, Rakuten. Reliance's network was so much better than its competitors that, you know, competitors had gone bankrupt because of the way they were able to price so much lower. And, you know, Rakuten is disintermediating in terms of where it's pricing in Japan versus the legacy networks. And we think, you know, Dish might not price a consumer offering at a massive discount. What they'll do is they'll wholesale out to, you know, the FANG companies in this network that really lends itself to, you know, to kind of creating the AWS of Amazon Web Services of wireless networks and portion it all out. Now, even though this is in sort of its execution phase right now and isn't a proven concept, we think that there's real downside protection here. So when we think of the network and, you know, if and when it gets fully built out, you know, Dish has a $20 billion market cap. T-Mobile has, you know, $130, $140 billion market cap. So there's multiples of upside we could see with Dish because the market is discounting, you know, Charlie Ergen's ability to build this network. But the nice thing here too is that when we look at just recent spectrum transactions and what spectrum is worth, we think that if Charlie can't build the network out and he decides to just sell the spectrum, we think, you know, that's worth $80 to $100 a share based on recent transactions where spectrum has exchanged hands, based on the recent C-band, which is an auction that the government auctioned off spectrum to the wireless carrier. So we think cable companies, wireless carriers all need spectrum for 5G. So should Dish not be able to build this network, there's real downside protection where, you know, the stock is trading at about $38 today. And we see that the asset value in a breakup in the $80 to $100 range. And we think, you know, should this network get built, the stock could be worth 200 plus, which is, you know, a phenomenal risk reward with real downside protection. The other example that I think is interesting for us to take a look at is Liberty Latin America, LILAC. And so this is a Latin American cable company. So they operate cable companies in a number of regions in the Caribbean, Central and South America. And they also own the only undersea fiber optic cable that connects the U.S. to the Caribbean, Mexico, and Central and South America. So the reason we think this business is so interesting is really this undersea fiber. What it allows LILAC to do is it allows them to roll up small cable companies. And so these cable companies tend to be managed not quite as well as LILAC is. They tend to not have any leverage on their balance sheet. And LILAC's owning the undersea fiber allows them to sort of send the data to these companies in these smaller markets to lower essentially the cost of providing service. And so what's so interesting here is that when we look at the acquisitions that LILAC has made over the last few years, after synergies, they're basically buying companies at 3 to 4 times free cash flow. And so when we layer the growth that LILAC is going to have in its current markets based on sort of middle class consumers in emerging markets, increasing the amount of cable broadband they use, just like we've seen in the US over the last 10, 12 years, we think that the organic business can really grow at about 30% a year, grow its cash flows. And on top of that, as they're executing sort of this levered acquisition strategy where they're rolling up all of these companies at, 3 to 4 times free cash flow, or call it 20 to 33% annualized returns, there's an ability to reinvest that cash flow at rates that allow sort of the increase in free cash flow per share to be about 40% per year. So, we get to something like $4 in earnings in about 4 years for LILAC on what is today a $14 stock. And again, we look at this similar to the company A versus company B example. This is a company that is the stock is cheap based on a number of reasons, mainly what's sort of happened with COVID and a reduction in tourist travel into the Caribbean. The fact that many South and Central American countries are slow to get vaccines. And so we think the stock is sort of misvalued in the short run because of that. And we think there's, once the world normalizes and as, this levered acquisition strategy plays out, we think there's huge upside here. And the last thing to mention is that this is a phenomenal, phenomenal management team. So the CEO, Balan Nair, was appointed in 2017. He's made real operating improvements across the markets in terms of basically improving brand names, offering better packages, replacing management teams in some of the companies that they have acquired. And, the largest shareholder in the business, and this is controlled by Dr. John Malone, he has just a history of building great media businesses, and you've seen significant insider buying over the last, 3 years at prices in even as high as $24, and the stock is at $14 today. So management really believes in what they're doing. They believe in the long-term story, and so do we. And the last thing I'll leave you on this example of is the downside protection. So we think that it's just, again, they're very smart in terms of how they're structuring debt at the subsidiary level. So that's non-recourse to the holding company. So should a hurricane happen in one of their markets, it shouldn't impair the overall value to the company as a whole. We also think the undersea cable is really worth the entire market cap of the company when you look at the multiples at which infrastructure companies have been, or infrastructure funds have been buying, one of a kind fiber optic assets. So again, we see something like $3 to $4 in free cash flow per share over the next 3 to 4 years on a $14 stock. We think there's, multiples of upside here at, even just 10 times free cash flow or earnings. So those are two examples of, well-managed long. So great management teams building value, reinventing the business, reinvesting the cash flow at great returns. One example of one of our opportunistic longs is Consolidated Communications, CNSL. So this has historically been a legacy phone company offering essentially DSL, which is internet over copper lines to customers in suburban and rural Maine, Vermont, and New Hampshire. So there are, the internet speeds on DSL are pretty slow and sort of don't even offer the ability to stream on Netflix in 4K. And so what you've had is sort of a flat to declining subscriber base. But we think the opportunity is changing. And, you know, the stock was as high as, $20 several years ago, and now it's down into the $6 range. And so we think things are changing. We think that what's happened is that they have an influx of capital from Searchlight, which is a very well-respected private equity firm in the tech media telecom space. And what they're doing with this capital is they're deploying fiber to the curb. So they have some fiber in their network, but you know the length of the cable from something like the end of the street to the home is all copper. And so that's where you lose the speed. And so speeds are slower over copper than obviously over fiber optic cable in terms of internet speeds. And so what they're doing here is that they're using that cash to upgrade their network to fiber all the way to the curb of the home. And so that cost, we look at the returns on, you know, what they can charge a customer if they're offering higher speeds. And so, again, we're looking at the unit economics here. We're looking at the cost to deploy that fiber. And what we've concluded is that as they use this capital to deploy and upgrade their network, they'll look more like a fiber optic network than an old copper network in a few years. But the market is still pricing this company like it's a declining copper business. Now, there is some risk to the strategy. The management team is good, but it's a typical management team that doesn't necessarily have the skin in the game that you have in something like a Lilac or a Dish. But we really think the opportunity can work out for them. So again, it's dicier because it's levered, we think that should the strategy work out, the market will start to see some of the benefits of a reduction in disconnects of customers when they're on the fiber optic network in as little as 9 months to a year. And when we think way out into the future, when their capital spending ends and that sort of capital spending massively declines and their free cash flow goes up and they're a more stable, different business, we think they can do something like $1.50 in free cash flow per share on what is a $6.50 stock now. So, we think that could be, a $12 to $15 stock in a couple years would move sort of a move up in the nearer term as people start to see the strategy playing out. So that's really kind of three investments in the portfolio. And one thing to just add to that is, we do not look at sort of daily stock price moves or, short-term stock price moves. We think about the value of the business over the long term. But what's notable is, a day like today where the Russell 2000, at least at 11:30, was down about 2%. Something like Consolidated Communications was down mid-single digits, whereas, Lilac and Dish were down 1.5%. And so, again, this just speaks to the, we don't look at short-term stock price moves, but it speaks to the lower volatility in some of these well-managed longs versus, the higher volatility in some of these names like Consolidated that are fraught with a little bit more risk. But again, this is why we size the positions accordingly.
Right. So you just gave three great examples. If we pull up a bit, how would you describe what is our edge?
That's a good question. So I think it's a number of things that I've hit on, and I'll kind of sum them all up here. So I think it's the feet on the streets research. Like I mentioned, we tend to run concentrated, but we look for the best opportunities with the best risk rewards. And there aren't, too many out there. And so we size those up because we really think we've found incredible opportunities. So, and that really comes from the feet on the streets research. So it's really how we're differentiating the signal from the noise, how we're thinking about sort of, the real world examples and, how managers are building these businesses. I think it's a small asset base. We're able to play in some of these really interesting niche opportunities because, our asset base is small and we're nimble, in our fund structure. I think similar to the feet on the streets research, our research is disciplined. Our process is disciplined. We are not sort of looking for what the new thing is that, the market's excited about today. We're really thinking about how businesses will look a few years down the road, what are they worth then? And, you know, we're stepping in when we think they'll be worth based on their free cash flow, based on their, on sort of the asset value, a lot more in the future than they are today. And, you know, what tends to happen in situations like that is if stocks go down, if our view hasn't changed on the business, you know, again, this intrinsic value approach where we value the business on the cash flows and the asset value. If, you know, a stock price goes down and our view on the business hasn't changed, it allows us to step in and be aggressive when, you know, other people are scared and pulling back. And that speaks to the temperament. And that temperament, so much of it comes from buying the right businesses and knowing they'll be able to withstand the volatility. And it also comes from, you know, a long-term investor base. Should our investors view us on multi-year time horizons, we can step in and buy these businesses that, you know, it might take a couple of years for Dish to really realize value. But when it does, we think the upside is just enormous. And same thing with Lilac. And so, you know, having a patient investor base that realizes sometimes these special situations, these asymmetric risk reward opportunities don't move with the market. And so, you know, you might have sort of SPACs going up every day. You might have, you know, cryptocurrency investments, those sorts of names, you know, going up in the short run, while, you know, we have managers in some of these businesses, like Lilac, for example, that is, looks at a lot of acquisitions and only pulls the trigger when they find a real opportunity. Sometimes that means we have to be patient. We have to sit and wait for them to do the right deal at the right price. And so it's important to have an investor base that understands this, of, you know, our LPs in Papyrus, and, you know, have them see that we're taking a lot less risk than the market. We think there's very little permanent impairment of capital or losses in the businesses we own, because they are, you know, real businesses that we're buying at great prices. And so I mean, I think really it's all of these factors coming together that allows us to, you know, invest with a great risk reward in businesses building value and great management teams.
Great. Well, thanks, Nitin. We'd like to open the discussion to questions from our participants. Again, if you have questions, please submit them using the question box on your screen. We have a question here, Nitin. What's the fund's legal structure for tax reporting purposes?
So the legal structure is effectively an onshore fund with sort of, you know, pooled investors or limited partners, and we issue K-1s. You know, in the first quarter of the following year, based on sort of the, you know, taxable gains in the pooled structure. And I think the nice thing for us is just when we find some of these well-managed longs, we can underwrite the business for a very long time horizon. So that gives us a phenomenal sort of, you know, tax profile in some of these longer term investments, you know, that we're holding for 3, 5, 7, 10 years.
Great. Thank you. If anyone has any other questions, please feel free to use the box. In the meantime, thank you, Nitin, and thanks for sharing your views with us. And we want to thank you all for joining us. What's striking to us all is that the innovation and that change that's making its way through society and our lives are making businesses increasingly having to think and rethink and at times reposition their products and their services. While this represents a very exciting time, and there's a significant amount of capital that can be built from this, but at the same time, it warrants a very thoughtful investment approach. At Papyrus, this is one of the strategies that we're managing, where we're applying this approach and we're applying it to our investment outlook and our process, and to do so in order to meet our clients' long-term needs. So with that, I don't see any other questions at the moment. With that, you know, we really appreciate
it. There's one more on fees. And so, you know, our fee structure is a 1.5% management fee. And then, you know, in our sort of founders class, we have a hurdle. And so that is a 4% hurdle where, you know, every year we have to hit a 4% rate of return before we take any incentive fees. And then on top of that, we take a 10% incentive fee.
Great. Great. Well, thanks for catching that question. So we greatly appreciate the trust and the confidence that you're all placing in us every day. And if you have any follow-up questions that you didn't have a chance to ask, please feel free to give us a call or reach out to us, and it would be a pleasure just to speak with you. So this concludes today's presentation, and thank you again for joining us.